Welcome to Signs of Life, exploring survival of consciousness, brought to you by the Forever Family Foundation on the web at www.foreverfamilyfoundation.org.
I can feel you like an ocean that won't seem to let me go.
Hello and welcome to Signs of Life, brought to you by Forever Family Foundation with our host, Bob Ginsberg. I'm Fran Ginsberg, and our show tonight is sponsored by the Comlock Center, and they can be found on the web at comlock.com. That's K-A-M-L-A-K.com. Our guest tonight is Dr. Julia Mossbridge, and if you have a question, comment, or would like to talk to our guest, the toll-free number here is 888-627-6008. So, Bob, any words of wisdom or deep thoughts for our listeners tonight?
Well, you showed me some words of wisdom last night. I mean, I'm still laughing about it. You know, everybody knows about those silly catalogs that you get, like that sell T-shirts, and they have all these witty sayings on them, and some of them are pretty bad, and some of them are quite clever. So Fran showed me a shirt, and it said on the shirt, "If I'm ever on life support, please pull the plug, and then plug it back in to see if that works," which I thought was a pretty funny line, obviously a joke, but it involves a serious topic, and it's worthy of discussion, and that is, you know, so many people have had to make a decision at the end of a loved one's life about taking extraordinary measures to keep that loved one alive. And people are all over the map, you know, on that. You know, some people say, well, I, you know, just do everything, and they encourage the doctors to keep, you know, trying. What are your thoughts on extraordinary measures?
Having been in that situation, I think that your instinct takes you to whatever you can do, do. If there's extraordinary measures that can be taken, or something that you've never ever tried before and you're willing to try it as a doctor, go for it. I think that when you are in the throes of the possibility of losing someone, that comes in as a natural response. When you look at it from the perspective of removed from the situation, then the argument goes to quality of life. Well, what if we revive them and then they're in a vegetative state for the rest of their lives? Or what if we could keep them on life support forever and ever and ever? So there's a lot of argument that goes on both sides of this thing, and both have merits only because we don't know enough about survival of consciousness. And we don't even know enough about medicine. About general biology and medical practices.
Yeah, and I think fear enters into it because we see it's not that rare anymore. It seems just last week I saw another article of I think it was a young boy that was pronounced dead, and just as the coroner was taking control, you know, of the body, somebody noticed a twitch under the covers, and they revived him, and he didn't have any, seemingly no lasting debilitating, effects from it.
And that's what I mean when I talk about they don't even know enough about medical science, let alone survival of consciousness science. Medical science, we've heard many stories. Isn't that unusual about this boy? Thank goodness somebody saw the draping move. But there are many stories that we've come across about that. And when they're revived and they've been out way longer than the period by which they're not going to have brain damage, and they come back and they are 100% themselves, there's no medical explanation for it. And it's not because there's really no medical explanation for it. It's because modern day medicine has already written and closed the book, and they're not exploring it because it will take them into survival of consciousness.
Right, and but then you have the situations where somebody has a horrible illness that's long and debilitating, and it's over a substantial period of time, and you see them, you know, wasting away before your eyes, and they're in pain, and they express the wish that, you know, that it's time, you know, it's time to go. That's a little bit different, you know, than fighting for somebody whose illness or accident was, you know, was unexpected and who didn't get a chance to express any wishes, you know. So in those cases, I think that family and doctors are doing the wrong thing by keeping somebody on life support with absolutely no quality of life for extended periods of time. Do you agree?
I'm going to go back to case by case.
Yeah.
Because, again, I have this deep belief in the universe or whatever it is that contract that we made or the journey that we're taking, everybody has a different exit. And just like the boy that you just described who came back to life under the covers, clearly, in his near-death experience, possibly, he was told, oh, no, it's not your time. You have to go back because you haven't completed what it was you incarnated for. So, by the same token, who are we to make the decisions of the person for the person who's on life support? You know, and you've also heard the stories where they finally decide that it can't go on like this, the body's deteriorating and the organs are shutting down, and let's remove them from life support and allow them to pass quietly. They remove them from life support, and then they come back.
Yeah, it doesn't happen often. It's a rare occurrence, but it happens.
It happens.
That's the point.
And that is the point.
But there are certain times, as we know, we've discussed this before, but, you know, deathbed visions, you know, and people that work in hospice and end-of-life situations, and they know that when somebody sees a deceased loved one and smiles and is happy and the demeanor changes, that they know that that's very, very close to the end. So I guess it's all about timing. You know, these people are anxious to go. So, you know, I don't know. I mean, if you saw somebody...
I don't think I'd use the word anxious. I think they've been shown the way, and they know that that's the right way to go. But I think kudos to all these wonderful hospice workers that have attuned themselves to the method by which these people who are getting ready to cross let them know that how close they are. You know, you'll talk to hospice workers and they'll say, well, somebody's here, but they're going to be here a long time. They're tuned in to the nuances of what goes on when they're getting closer and closer to death.
Right. So it sounds like you're leaning towards a belief that it's not up for us to judge the time. You
no.
Know?
I think only our soul knows when it's ready to go.
Yeah. What about the people, there was just something in the news a couple of days ago of this gentleman from, but he was going to Switzerland, or he was leaving Switzerland, but he was going to a country where they allow assisted suicide.
Yeah.
He said he's 104 years old, his body was, you know, decaying, it's his time, he's ready to go. What about
He knew.
Well...
It's his decision to make. It's his body. It's his soul. And I am also of the belief that, let's just say for argument's sake, he made a mistake. He really wasn't supposed. He's really had one more thing to do, or he hasn't completed it, or he was supposed to be 105 when, or whatever the story is. Then he'd come back. It wouldn't work.
Or something.
I mean,
something would. Yeah, something.
Let's just go to. States where they have the death penalty,
right.
and these people are subjected to death. That's their sentence, and then it doesn't work.
We're going to go to our break. We have a great guest tonight, Dr. Julia Mossbridge, so stay with us, and we'll be back in a couple of minutes.
The CAMLAC Center is putting birth and death back together again. Aimed at changing the way we look at death, the CAMLAC Center was founded in 2002 as a publishing company and teaching center. When we know that there is nothing but life, we realize that birth and death are events in time and space. Our grief can open us to other dimensions of reality and allow us to experience our loved ones who are no longer in the physical body. Our events and products are based on personal experiences of survival of consciousness after physical death and decades of research into how death has influenced the development of our consciousness. Visit www.camlac.com, that's K-A-M-L-A-K.com, for articles, videos, books, and more to help you cope with the loss of a loved one.
We all grieve in different ways, and let's face it, grief hurts. Losing a loved one is usually the hardest event we will ever face. We can throw our hands up and become hardened by our grief, or we can take positive steps to transform it. Love Knows No Death, a groundbreaking and powerful grief transformation method, can be what you've been looking for to provide some peace and understanding. It was created and written by medical doctor and professor Dr. Piero Calvi Perazzetti, and it's a combination of a self-help workbook and video course. The workbook has the power to lessen grief and foster significant healing, and has already helped countless people to not only lead productive lives, but to do so with the knowledge that they will indeed see their loved ones again. The workbook could be purchased for $19.95 on Amazon or on the foreverfamilyfoundation.org grief and loss page, where a digital version is also available for $9.95. Love knows no death. Truer words have never been spoken.
Learning to Dance in the Rain, a true story about life beyond death. When 21-year-old Maya dies in a tragic car crash, her parents begin to experience profound synchronicities, prophetic dreams, guidance from mediums, and the undeniable truth that death is not the end. Lori and Brian McDermott share their story, hoping to help others find strength and inspiration to face whatever storms life may bring. Learn more about this important book at www.learningtodanceintherain.net. That's www.learningtodanceintherain.net.
I would like to introduce you to the Forever Family Foundation, a nonprofit organization whose mission is to provide a forum where individuals and families who have suffered the loss of a loved one can turn for support, information, and hope. We believe in the continuity of the family, even though a member has left the physical world. The Forever Family Foundation is a joint effort of scientists, research mediums, and interested people who support the premise that life does not end with physical death. We wish to prove that the bond of the family cannot be broken even by death. We invite anyone who's trying to cope with the loss of a loved one to contact the Forever Family Foundation at 631-425-7707. That's 631-425-7707. Or you can find us on the web at foreverfamilyfoundation.org.
Welcome back to Signs of Life, brought to you by the Forever Family Foundation.
Just tuning in, our guest this evening is Dr. Julia Mossbridge. Our sponsor tonight is the CAMLAC Center, and they can be found on the web at CAMLAC.com. Bob?
And we're very happy to introduce Dr. Julia Mossbridge. She's the founder and research director of Mossbridge Institute and is the director of the Innovation Lab at the Institute of Noetic Sciences. She's also a visiting scholar in the psychology department at Northwestern University, the science director at Focus at Will Labs, and an associate professor in integral and transpersonal psychology at the California Institute of Integral Studies. She also invented and patented Choice Compass, a physiologically based decision-making app. Dr. Mossbridge is also the author of Unfolding the Perpetual Science of Your Soul's Work, The Garden, an Inside Experiment, and co-author of The Transcendent Mind, Rethinking the Science of Consciousness. And the website to learn more is mossbridgeinstitute.com. And welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here.
And great to finally invite you on, and we're very happy that you're here. So when we discuss anomalous or psi phenomena, we most often reference all the scientific studies that have been done over the years that have been conducted using strict protocol, and the evidence we know is very abundant. But many people in the general public, and certainly a large number in the scientific community, tend to dismiss the huge volume of anecdotal evidence. So, I mean, we know that personal experience often has the power to transform our beliefs. So do you think that science is making a mistake by continuing to ignore personal experience?
Well, for scientists, it depends on what kind of scientist you are, right? So a geologist has no, I don't think there's that much of a problem there with ignoring personal experience unless there's a possibility that rocks, for instance, have personal experience. But let's just assume that only sort of animals and humans have subjective experience. Anyone who studies animals and humans definitely would be making a mistake if they were to ignore subjective or phenomenological experience. I mean, or just phenomenology, so what happens. On the other hand, I don't want to say everyone's making that mistake, because if you're studying, you know, if your real focus is on the epigenetics of trauma, then you better understand subjective experience, because you have to understand what trauma is subjectively to someone. And then if your focus is on understanding how the cuticle works, maybe you don't have to worry about that so much. So I guess I would say that any neuroscientist or psychologist who's interested in consciousness and experience better understand what they're studying.
Mm. But there's many of your colleagues. I'm sure you're very much aware or somewhat biased when it comes to any discussion of psi phenomena. They summarily dismiss it. And you give them the evidence and they choose to ignore it. So why do you mm-hmm. suppose that is? Is it a fear factor? Does it challenge them? Does it challenge their education?
For some of them, I don't know. I mean, so it depends again on the person. So for some people, it's because I think for the most part, anyone who hasn't had a psi experience is more likely to challenge it because it seems nonsensical. So if by psi experiences, what you're really talking about are experiences like having a communication with someone who has died, or knowing something across time or space that it doesn't seem like you would have any way to know except through psychic means, or participating in moving something, or changing something in the world simply through the use of your intention or your mental abilities. These are what people are calling, you know, psi experiences. And for those who haven't ever had the experience of something very compelling like that happened that they couldn't explain in other ways, they're most likely to be the people who question it. Just like anything else. Like if I told you I was studying how 13 fairies are in control of every word that you say, but we just don't know it. You might say, well, I don't find that very compelling because I don't have the experience that 13 fairies are in control of everything we say, you know?
Right. Yeah.
It's the same problem that actually quantum physicists have when explaining Well, I'm studying how, you know, a particle can be in two places at the same time, or one characteristic of the particle could be here and the other characteristic of the particle could be there. And people are like, what? Because that's not what we think. That's not how we think the world works. So I think primarily that's the number one issue with communicating these findings to other scientists. And then the other issue is a lot of them are tricky, and by tricky I mean difficult to reproduce. And so while they've been reproduced at levels beyond chance expectation, it's not like your typical physics experiments where you can get a bunch of undergrads or high school students and set up an inclined plane, and the ball pretty much rolls down the inclined plane unless there's something stopping it. So it's trickier to set up, just like any psychology experiment is. You just don't get the same result all the time because of all the different factors that are affecting the outcome.
I remember you know, years ago when I first started looking into psi in general, and I would read the studies from Dean Radin's books and certain experiments that had odds against chance in the millions and billions to one, and I got so excited, like this was a breakthrough, and that everybody, how could they possibly refute this and not acknowledge the existence, and yet, you know, life just goes on and continues to get ignored. It's frustrating.
Well, I mean, exactly. I mean, I remember reading those books too, and that's part of what brought me into the field, aside from my own personal experiences. But when you sort of look at the field and actually do these experiments, you see, like, okay, you know, I tried it again, and this time I didn't get that same result, and I tried it again, and this time I did. And so you see that it's easy if you don't have sort of your own personal experiences that are very clear to draw from. It's easy to just say, oh, it's too much effort to try to figure out all these factors and to try to reduce the noise so that you have a higher signal-to-noise ratio. So I'll just, just say it doesn't exist. And that's really the easier path. And it's the accepted path. So people, you know, you're sort of made, as a scientist, you're made to seem foolish if you're willing to say, hey, I really do think that time doesn't work the way we think it does, and I really do think that consciousness might be able to be separate from the body and things like this.
Right.
So you definitely, as a scientist in this field, every scientist I know who studies psi stuff has had personal experiences that have convinced them beyond the shadow of a doubt that this stuff is going on.
Yeah. When we talk about mind-to-mind communication, telepathy, many people wonder, is there an actual signal that's sent from one mind to another? And if so, can that signal or that energy be measured? What are your thoughts on that?
Let's see. So that's a telepathy kind of question. So the telepathy is sort of defined as, you've got these minds and they're both having a similar experience or able to report on something. And multiple times you would do an experiment, and in order to show that it's really telepathy, they'd multiple times instead of, you know, just one time, you'd have to show that these two minds are able to think the similar things or the same thing at the same time. And so one explanation is, we think of like a radio, right, like a two-way radio or a phone. So there's an actual signal between. Another explanation is that they're both tapping into a source of information that is outside those minds. So it's almost like tapping into what we call in the book transcendent mind. We call it the transcendent mind. So they're tapping into sort of an extended mind that has information that both of them draw on. And to me, that seems a little more appealing, partly because the signal model doesn't match with the data, so that you could have two people separated by thousands of miles and have immediate or seemingly immediate transfer of information. And so that suggests that any signal that we know of, which is, you know, based on some kind of electromagnetic signal generally, and those kind of signals are they're going to decay as you get further from the source. And the other question is, where's the source, right? So is the source in the person who's sort of sending the information? We think of it as a sender and a receiver. But that doesn't really jive with people's experiences. It's sort of like something comes into your head. Or something, if you're, quote, the sender in these experiments, you might be looking at a computer screen with a randomly generated video or image, and you're just experiencing it. I guess intuitively, although it's very hard to separate these sort of models. Intuitively, I think that there's sort of a non-signal-like signal.
Right.
So let me explain that. I think it's like a non-signal in the sense that, it's not going between the two brains. Both brains are both minds are simultaneously tapping into the extended mind in a sort of spontaneous, immediate quantum entanglement type of, I'm not saying it's quantum entanglement, but kind of like quantum entanglement in that it's simultaneous and instantaneous.
So that would be a similar process in mediumistic communication, I would imagine. You know, that the discarnate consciousness and the person in the physical are tapping into some source, a common source. Yeah.
Right. I mean, so if there's these individual minds, you know, I mean, we're pretty confident that we have individual minds. Most people agree on that, and I think there's some evidence for an extended mind that is connected across people so that it's not just me and it's not just you. It's something we can all share. And so, yeah, one model is of medium communication, but also even, you know, plain old telepathy is that same kind of thing. I'm not sure that mediums are doing anything different than telepathy. It's just that there's no body there.
Right. Yeah. That makes sense. You know, in the book, In Transcendent Mind, you write a little bit about survival and communications with the dead, and communications that are spontaneous and some that are through mediums and some that are induced. And you talked about a personal experience that you had with Alan Botkin that I'm interested in because we're familiar with his work. Can you tell us a little bit about your own personal experience?
Yeah, sure. That was such a funny time. I was I had left graduate school in neuroscience. I took my master's, a terminal master's in a PhD program, because I was just unhappy with the way neuroscience was being conducted, and it was extremely competitive and reductionistic, and I was at a institution that was very, you know, proud of its reputation, but at the same time was doing work that was just very, very materialistic. And So I left, and I didn't know what to do. So one of the many jobs that I got was I did freelance writing for a local newspaper, and I was the body mind health columnist. And one of the assignments I gave to myself was to go check out this guy Alan Botkin, who I'd heard about, and he claimed that he could help people communicate with dead people by using the EMDR, the eye movement protocol.
Right.
And, you know, you've talked to him, you know about his protocol. My experience was I walked into the room. Here's this totally normal guy, doctor, sits me down, has literally a stick. Like, I expected something high-tech. Literally has a little wand with a piece of tape on the end. I'm not kidding. And
I know.
I'm like, yeah, I know. So I'm like, is this ridiculous? And so I'm like, sure, okay, let's see what this is like. He tells me, look, thanks for coming to check this out. Here's my story. And he tells me about his story, about how he discovered this stuff. And I'm just like, it sounds totally like some placebo and some, people with their imaginations. But if it's helpful, maybe it's helpful, you know. Maybe it's helpful to people with PTSD or whatever. So he starts doing it, and he just says to me, by doing it, I mean he waves this thing back and forth rhythmically in front of my eyes and asks me to follow it. And as I'm following it with my eyes, he says, sort of think of a person that you'd like to hear from. And so immediately I have this internal sort of vision of this kid that I knew in college who had died. And, it was a difficult death. I mean, of course, in college, every death is difficult, and perhaps deaths are always difficult. But in any case, he was young. He was only, a sophomore or junior in college. And he was driving up from another college to come visit me. And I had told him if he came, I was joking with him. And he was coming to see a performance that I was doing with his sister. And I said, if you come up, maybe we could have sex or something. But I was joking because it's my sister's brother, my friend's brother. And I was laughing because we were doing a performance about safe sex because this was the 90s and the AIDS epidemic was happening. So anyway, he came up, and on the way he got hit by a truck and killed. And I felt guilt because I had, joked with him about, we'll have sex if you come up. And, sorry?
I was just chuckling.
Yeah, I know. It's just like I wasn't even honest about it, and I thought, oh no, you know.
Yeah.
And so I was teasing, and I hope he knew that. And so anyway, I was feeling guilty, and I wanted to see him and just sort of say I was sorry. But he appeared, and then Alan guided me to sort of have a conversation with him. So I did, and he said, look, I'm fine. And I thought, oh, of course he would say he's fine. That's what I want him to say, you know. I want to feel better. And he said, you know, it's fine. It wasn't your fault, da-da-da-da. And I'm like, of course, of course. I have this running narrative that's saying, of course, he says this. This is just everything I want someone, you know, in this situation to say. And I did notice he was with this golden retriever, who was very friendly, and he was petting the golden retriever, and they were both, like, super happy. And I said, okay, I'm done. And Alan said, well, what did you experience? And I told him what I experienced, and I said, look, it sounds to me like I saw exactly what I wanted to see, and I certainly am not convinced I talked with anyone. And he's like, okay, well, whatever. You know, this seems to help. Do you feel better? And I said, yeah, I do feel better, but I don't know if I made it up. So in the car on the way home, I thought, you know, what it was with that dog? So I decided to call my friend who was this guy's sister and said, look, I had this experience, and I also saw this dog there, and I was wondering what you thought. And she said, well, it sounds like an interesting experience, but I just want you to know, a year after my brother died, my parents got a dog, and a year after that, near the date that my brother died, the dog was also killed on the highway, and it was a golden retriever. And I did not know that. And so all this information happened before I wrote the article. So then when I wrote the article, I was blown away, and I was just like, okay, so I think I first thought this was bogus, and now I think there's something to it, because that was too specific and weird, and I hadn't known that before.
Yeah. Funny how personal experience can change your way you think.
100%.
Yeah.
And I still don't know if that was telepathy, you know, or if that, but regardless, I got information about, you know, this being who had died that I didn't know had died in relationship with this other being that I did know had died. And so to me, that means something.
Mm. How do you view the psi ability that people have? I mean, it's in varying degrees. Is it a talent? Is it a gift? I mean, why do you suppose that some people have very strong abilities in these areas and others seemingly little or no ability?
Yeah. Well, part of me says this. Part of me says, oh, it's like any talent. You know, some people are musical and some people are not. And even the people who aren't musical, if you give them piano lessons or if you give them singing lessons or drum lessons or something, they can maybe learn. But it's hard. It's like it's difficult for them. And then other people, it's easy, and you can give them piano lessons or singing lessons and they can become virtuosos. And so it's like any other talent. And then another part of me says, no, it's an innate part of who we are as human beings. And it's there and it's available to come through, but it can only come through in people who are sort of broken in some way. I mean, because the evidence suggests that people who haven't had much childhood trauma and such tend not to have these kind of experiences. And it's almost like that Leonard Cohen song, I think it's called Anthem, where he says, ring the bell that you can ring, forget the perfect offering, for there's a crack in everything and it's where the light comes in.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there might be something to that, that the light can come in when you've been broken. And so it's almost like a coping mechanism or an adaptive feature.
Yeah, I mean, it makes sense. We've noticed over the years that a lot of the mediums have had various forms of physical and emotional trauma in their lives, you know, and so that would make sense. And I mean, it also seems that emotion plays a part in telepathic type of communication, you know, whether that be love or hate or whatever. So I would tend to agree, you know, that about being broken or emotions being a conduit. You know, I think I believe in both of them. Yeah. We're going to go to a break. We're talking with Dr. Julia Mossbridge, and the book, her latest book is The Transcendent Mind, Rethinking the Science of Consciousness. Website is mossbridgeinstitute.com. We have a lot more to talk about. Stay with us. We'll be back in a few minutes.
the CAMLAC Center is putting birth and death back together again. Aimed at changing the way we look at death, the CAMLAC Center was founded in 2002 as a publishing company and teaching center. When we know that there is nothing but life, we realize that birth and death are events in time and space. Our grief can open us to other dimensions of reality and allow us to experience our loved ones who are no longer in the physical body. Our events and products are based on personal experiences of survival of consciousness after physical death and decades of research into how death has influenced the development of our consciousness. Visit www.camlac.com, that's K-A-M-L-A-K.com, for articles, videos, books, and more to help you cope with the loss of a loved one.
Am I Psychic is a mobile app designed using statistics, science, and parapsychological protocols to test psychic ability using fun games. Each game has two unique modes. In psychokinesis mode, influence the game using mind over matter ability. In extrasensory perception mode, guess which random option will be chosen. Am I Psychic can store your results in an anonymous database used to eventually publish in academic journals. Available on the App Store and Google Play. Go to ampsychicapp.com and be a part of proving psychic phenomena to the world. Some profits will be donated to the Rhine Research Center.
When grieving the loss of a loved one, sometimes a hug is just what you need. Hugs from Heaven are lightly weighted shoulder wraps that are made from the fabric of your loved one's clothing. Your clothing can also be made into memory pillows and sachets. Each Hugs from Heaven is handmade with loving care and is as unique as your loved one's spirit. Visit us at hugsfromheaven.com. That's hugs, spelled with a Z, from heaven.com. Who couldn't use a hug?
We all grieve in different ways, and let's face it, grief hurts. Losing a loved one is usually the hardest event we will ever face. We can throw our hands up and become hardened by our grief, or we can take positive steps to transform it. Love Knows No Death, a groundbreaking and powerful grief transformation method, can be what you've been looking for to provide some peace and understanding. It was created and written by medical doctor and professor Dr. Piero Calvi Perazzetti, and it's a combination of a self-help workbook and video course. The workbook has the power to lessen grief and foster significant healing, and has already helped countless people to not only lead productive lives, but to do so with the knowledge that they will indeed see their loved ones again. The workbook could be purchased for $19.95 on Amazon or on the foreverfamilyfoundation.org grief and loss page, where a digital version is also available for $9.95. Love Knows No Death. Truer words have never been spoken.
Welcome back to Signs of Life, brought to you by the Forever Family Foundation.
If you're just tuning in, we have been talking to Dr. Julia Mossbridge. Our sponsor is the CAMLAC Center, and they could be found on the web at CAMLAC.com. We want to remind our listeners to check the events page on our website, foreverfamilyfoundation.org, for all the latest events and happenings. Our free events coming up next month, we have on June 9th from 2 to 3 p.m. Eastern. That's 11 to noon Pacific, our Visionary Explorers group. It's an online meeting. On June 9th, again, from 1 to 3 p.m. Eastern Time, the Afterlife Discussion Group meets in Miami, Florida. And on June 12th, from 6:45 p.m. to 8:45 p.m. Eastern, the Afterlife Discussion Group meets in Cold Spring Harbor, New York. Our next webinar is set for June 27th at 9 p.m. Eastern, when Maureen Seberg will present Synesthesia and the Phenomenon of Near-Death and Out-of-Body Experiences. The webinars are $6 for members, $20 for non-members, but for our listeners, here are some promo codes to the webinar. You can get free member-only seats if you use the promo code Synesthesia, and I'm not going to spell it for you, and half price seats for our non-members, you use the promo code Seberg2018. And just a reminder, non-members reserving at the member-only rate will be billed for the correct amount. Unpaid invoices remaining on the date of the webinar will result in registration cancellation. Our annual summer grief retreat in Chester, Connecticut is set for August 17th through 19th. Here is what one of the many past attendees have said about the experience. I was lucky enough to attend their annual grief retreat in July, and it was an experience that helped me tremendously. Being around people who were going through the same thing as me and searching for answers and contact from our loved ones, I love that they focus on the science and proof that our consciousness survives our physical body. And that wraps up the description of what you get at our annual grief retreats. It's a complete weekend working with Forever Family Foundation certified mediums and experienced facilitators. It is deliberately kept small and designed to transform your grief. The accommodations are private and the food has been described as locally grown fabulous. Details and registration links are on our website. Registration has begun for our biennial weekend in Fort Myers, Florida this coming November 9th through 11th. Mediums behind the scenes. Imagine spending a weekend with six Forever Family Foundation certified mediums along with noted experts on the afterlife. The event features frequent spirit communication, small teaching workshops, and group presentations, all designed to facilitate connections, foster your own communications with spirit, and learn about what happens after death. We also have a lot of fun things planned for the weekend, and our unusual simple pricing includes both Friday and Saturday night banquets with entertainment and spirit communication. And following November comes December, particularly December 23rd, when we will draw five winners who will each win a reading with a Forever Family Foundation certified medium in our annual Holidays Past raffle. It's only $5 to enter. And please, please, please help keep all of our programs going by visiting our website and clicking on the donation button. It's on every single page. Because of the work we do not receive the grants and funding that all traditional not-for-profits enjoy. You can also help us pay our bills by participating in iGive.com, Amazon.com, Amazon Smile, and great nonprofits. Bob?
And we're back with Dr. Julia Mossbridge. The book is Transcendent Mind, Rethinking the Science of Consciousness. It's an excellent book that explores the nature of consciousness and may change the way you think about it. Website is mossbridgeinstitute.com. I know that you write, Julia, about the nature of time a bit, and you know, a lot of philosophers and physicists will tell you that time does not even exist. It's a concept, and it's a concept that many people find difficult to grasp, because our whole lives seem to be centered around linear time. So what are your thoughts about the nature of time? I mean, some people say past, present, and future exist simultaneously. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, I've been thinking about this for a long time. And I, at this point, can adopt almost any view. I can justify sort of almost any view of time in terms of what I say I could justify. I mean, there's like scientific evidence for almost any view of time. So there's scientific evidence for what you're talking about, the past, future, and present existing simultaneously, is the block model of the universe. So introduced, or at least popularized by Einstein in his work on special relativity. So it's this idea that everything that has happened, is happening, and is going to happen already sort of in some way exists, that we're traveling through it, like you might travel through a painting. We don't see it yet, but it's there, a particular event. That's appealing to me because, first of all, it fits with the data. But second, it's appealing because intuitively, I feel like when we point to ourselves, if I ask you, who are you? You might point to your head or your belly or your heart, you know, usually one of those areas. And you say, here I am, this is me, and you're pointing to your body. But aren't you also, I mean, forgetting even the mind part of you, aren't you also the body that existed 2 minutes ago and the body that will exist 2 minutes from now? How is that not you? And so if you start to stretch that out from your very birth to your death, you're all of those. That's really all of you. And that seems like a more accurate description of how we think about ourselves, really kind of stretched out in time. We talk about when I was a kid, or what I want to be when I grow up, or what I want to do when I die, or how I want that to be. And then even beyond the body, the mind would potentially, you know, exist before and birth and after death in this extended mind sense. And so to me, that not only fits with the physics data, but also with our subjective experience of what we call ourselves. But then there's folks, physicists, who say, you know, so there's no such thing as time. So there's just a block universe, but we're not traveling through it, and we just have this illusion of traveling through it. And, okay, that's true, but we still have to explain the illusion. I mean, that could be true, but we have to explain the illusion. And then you have physicists who say, you know, frankly, time is fundamental. It exists, and it exists in a real way, way more than other physicists are speaking. So this is like Lee Smolin is sort of this view. And so he and others like him are saying time is like this thing. It's like almost like a field or a force or something, and it can actually, you know, evolve the laws of physics, you know. And so they could change from one generation to the next, or maybe in 1,000 years, you know, gravitational constant will be different. So there's that. And then there's people who can say that time is equivalent to consciousness. I sort of think that could be true, too. Like, our conscious waking experience could be, it's hard to separate our conscious waking daily experience from the passage of time. If you try to, you find yourself talking about the same thing. You say, well, we know time is passing because we see or experience this or this or this. Well, that's kind of what that's how people describe conscious waking daily experience. And so I guess I sort of feel like the task in trying to understand what time is a cutting-edge task in physics and philosophy right now, and in psychology, too, and in neuroscience. And it requires creating a model that takes all of these things that actually work in all of those fields and that have really good predictions, but also weave in sort of anomalous observations that haven't been fitting anywhere. Things like the reality of precognition, you know, the statistical sort of anomaly that precognition is, the reality of what's called retrocausation, which is discussed more and more in quantum physics, among quantum physicists, because there's evidence for it at the quantum level, and trying to understand how those kind of things and our sense of causality will fit in with what we're calling time. And I think what will happen is eventually causality will go out the window as something that has to go forward in time, and in fact may go out the window entirely. I mean, John von Neumann once said, frankly, causality, there's no way to prove it. It doesn't exist. How, you know, even if you take a billion ball and strike it by another billion ball 1,000 times, and it moves away, the second ball moves away from the first ball every time, all you ever have is a correlation. How would you ever show that it's the first ball that actually caused the second ball to move away? You can't ever show that. And so once you let go of causality, time moving in either forward, what we call forward or backward, no longer has much meaning. It's just, we're just observing things.
You know, before we run out of time, would you mind taking a call from one of our listeners?
Oh, no, not at all.
Okay.
We have Darlene on the line.
Okay. Well, Darlene.
Okay. Hello.
Hi.
This is Darlene.
Hi.
And I would just like, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say you're on, you know, with Dr. Mossbridge, and you have a question for her?
Well, I have a comment, actually. Something that I know is that if our consciousness did not go on, there would be no point with us in our physical bodies to stay here after our first disappointment. That's how I look at it. You know, you know, there'd be no point. There's got to be a point to everything you pretty much do. So I have learned that when you're feeling like this isn't worth it, you have to think about, well, wait a minute, there's a point or I wouldn't be here.
Yeah. Well, it, you know, it wouldn't make sense. I mean, it goes back to some people think that everything in the physical world is random and without meaning and purpose and just happened. And there are others that think that it's all part of a creative, integrative design, you know, which is obviously what you believe.
Yeah. Well, what I think is it's both.
Yeah.
And it's up to the consciousness to separate what is the physical and what is the consciousness, and, you know, why it's happening. And some stuff, you know, is just, to me, is just happening because it is.
Yeah. Julia, you have any thoughts on that?
Well, I think generally one of the biggest shifts that people can make in their life is to recognize that you could allow the future to call you forward. So the future can, if you don't believe that consciousness extends past the body, the future can still call you forward when you're going through difficult times, because mm-hmm. you can visualize, you know, positive times and allow that to call you forward. If you have the feeling that consciousness exists beyond the death of the body, or it can be separated from body, then you can allow that to call you forward even further into the future. So to me, it's a similar concept applied to different points. But I think that for some people, they're capable of saying, okay, maybe my consciousness extends past the death of my body, and then they have sort of an even further point to call themselves forward.
Yes, yes. And sometimes you think you're doing it yourself, and there's nobody,
yeah.
there's no other consciousness involved, but I don't believe that's true.
Well, it's easy to figure out that that's not true. I mean,
yeah.
even
yeah.
most neuroscientists don't believe that's true. So, yeah.
Right. Well, thank you, darling. Okay. Thanks for calling in.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Yeah. It's interesting when we talk about the nature of time and what you were just saying, because a lot of the experiential things, like near-death experiences, seems to be a common thing that you know, time doesn't exist in the realm in which that they travel to. And, you know, we have remote viewers who see targets that haven't existed yet or existed in the past.
Mm-hmm.
So the nature of time certainly doesn't seem to be linear at all.
Right. Remote viewing. I've practiced remote viewing for a while so that I could understand what was going on, and then that I could do experiments in remote viewing. And the more I practice it, this actually goes into a book that's coming out in the fall, Premonition Code. But the more I practice it, the more I find that my ability to get information from the future accurately is just, it just keeps going up. And so I do think that kind of thing can be trained.
Mm. See, that's what I like about you, Julia. You know, you have you're the left brain credentialed scientist, and then there's that experiential right brain side of you that likes to do things. So it's a good.
I like to do both.
I know. I wanted to. We're running out of time, unfortunately, and maybe you can come back again. I really wanted to ask you about the garden, you know, which maybe we could talk about the next time. But let me remind everybody that the book is called Transcendent Mind, Rethinking the Science of Consciousness. There's actually a link on the Foundation website if you would like to purchase that on Amazon. And the website, again, is mossbridgeinstitute.com. Thank you so much for being with us tonight, and it was wonderful, and I hope you'll join us again in the future.
Thanks so much. It was delightful.
Okay, thanks. Take care.
We now ask our listeners to please join us in our Healing Energy Circle prayer. May the universe create a channel of healing energy from our participating listeners, sending that energy to those who are in need of recovery of the physical body, spirit, and mind, as we visualize the healing light upon Angelina Diana, Robin Murray, Joanne Gerber, Diane Archangel, and Marianne Pierzga. Now let us as one consciousness give our energy of loving thought by praying like this. To love one another, to treat others as we would like to be treated, to forgive others and return love for hate, kindness for anger, to spread this feeling to everyone, to our fellow man as well as the earth and its environment. And now it's time to say...
Our loved ones are only a heartbeat away.
And science is going to prove it.
Good night, everyone.